morning. I'm Mark Riley here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. I'm upset. Mark Maron's not here. But it is Morning Sedition. It's 6 minutes past the hour. That would be 6 o'clock if you're on the East Coast. That'd be 3 o'clock if you're on the West Coast. And in downtown Baghdad, Lord knows what time it is. But good morning to everyone who is listening this morning. And I want to say special good mornings to those who are on their way home from their second job so they can go to sleep and then go to their first job. Want to say good morning to all those people in the people moving business, whether you're a cabbie, a subway train operator, a bus driver, commuter light rail engineers, all of you who are in the business of moving people from one place to another, because I know most of you are up about now. Good morning to all of you. Special good morning to all of you who are waking up this morning and find the White House as your ultimate destination, because y'all got problems. I got news for you right now. There's a lot of stuff going on, and Lord knows how Bush and his people are going to deal with the onslaught of bad news, the onslaught of cronyism, the onslaught of scandal that is enveloping the White House like a cloud, like a mushroom cloud. Good morning, Dan Pashman.
Hey, Mark, how are you?
I'm doing all right, man.
Happy Friday to you.
Oh, is it Friday?
It is.
Damn, okay.
It feels good.
Yeah, it feels good. But again, I don't think it feels so good if your name is George W. Bush, or maybe even if your name is Harriet Myers,
yeah,
and you've had
sure.
a couple people send you home to do your homework over. Okay, and,
yeah, right.
and apparently because you were lying like a rug in some of it. But we'll get to that in a little bit. Special good morning to people who are preparing for the onslaught of Hurricane Wilma. It's already lashed the Yucatan Peninsula and may be heading for South Florida as we speak, although now they're saying it may not get there till Sunday. Yesterday it was Saturday. It's still a Category 4. Still got winds up to 150-some-odd miles an hour. So, folks, if you're in the path, I know a lot of folks like to be, well, we were here for Hurricane Charlie, and that wasn't a big problem. And look, be careful, all right? If they tell you to get out, get out.
Yeah,
trust me.
I think if there was one good thing that came out of Hurricane Katrina, it's that it scared some other people straight, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Later this morning, by the way, we're going to be talking a little bit about a really ugly story that's coming out of Guantanamo. Of course, the Guantanamo Detention Center down in Cuba. And there's been so much ugliness out of prisons and detention centers around the world, whether it's Abu Ghraib or whether it's Guantanamo. We're going to be talking with someone who's been fighting the good fight against detainee abuse at Guantanamo. And yes, folks, it is still going on. But we'll jump back to D.C. for a minute and talk about George W. Bush. You know, he went out to California 6 months ago, folks, when George W. Bush went out to one of these places out in the hustings to campaign for somebody or to raise money for somebody. People were rejoicing. People were as happy as they could be. It was like, oh, it's the president of the United States. Not anymore. George W. Bush apparently went out to California to raise some money for the Republican National Committee. And guess who was upset?
Who?
The California Republican Committee, who's trying to get Arnold Schwarzenegger passed an election. And they said, why is he coming out here raising money for the RNC when Arnold, apparently, with all that money he's got, has not made his $50 million goal yet? And I imagine the time is running short for the poor man. But it just goes to show California Republicans saying, hey, look, George, stay out of here. Okay, this is the biggest, by the way, state in the country population-wise. And they're saying to George W. Bush, sorry, we don't need you. We don't want you. Arnold wouldn't even sit with the guy.
This is a pretty huge turnaround, Mark. I mean, you know, this guy, even as recently as 6 months ago, Bush was still mostly a golden boy to the Republicans, and they were jumping over each other. Certainly before November 2nd and the immediate aftermath of his reelection, they were jumping over each other just to stand next to the guy.
Not anymore.
To think that these guys are running for the hills, that they flat out, for Schwarzenegger to be quoted in the press, it's one thing to say it in the back channels, but to be quoted in the press saying, gee, we wish he hadn't come here.
Yeah, right? That is embarrassing.
That's a big statement.
But you know what? It's a big statement that George W. Bush left Washington in the first place.
Yeah.
Because at this point, he's really got no reason to hang out. His people seem to be getting ready to go down. And, you know, Bush now is in his best Alfred E. Newman, what me worry mode in terms of how he's dealing with all this. Now, the people around him are all scared to death because they're afraid Karl Rove is going to get indicted and they won't know what to do about anything after that. But Bush himself is apparently maintaining a very calm demeanor. The firestorm around the Plaingate thing, the firestorm around Harriet Myers, the firestorm around an unfinished agenda that will probably never be finished during this man's presidency. This does not bother him one bit. We have a piece of tape of George W. Bush describing the swirl around the Capitol. Can we hear that?
There's some background noise here. A lot of chatter. A lot of speculation and opining. But the American people expect me to do my job, and I'm going to.
Isn't that something? Opining. Wow, I wonder how long it took him to get that one out of the thesaurus or wherever he dug it up from. Opining. I think that's the deepest word I've heard George W. Bush say in about 5-odd years or so. But you know what? The Fitzgerald grand jury is going to be concluding next week. Its official life ends on October 28th. And, of course, all the focus, all the speculation, all the rumor, all the background noise that Bush was talking about is, you know, centered around who, if anyone, will be indicted and for what will they be indicted. Now, a couple of things are in order to say to people right here, right now, okay? An indictment is a damaging thing, okay? Ask Tom DeLay, even that big smile, and we'll get into this a little later. Yeah. Big smile he had at his booking, believe me, he may have had some Depends undergarments on, because this is not a fun thing that he's got in front of him. An indictment is a damaging thing, but ladies and gentlemen, it is not the same as a conviction. We may delight in seeing these guys being let out in handcuffs. We may delight in seeing Tom DeLay smiling. But the end game here, and we must never lose sight of the fact that the end game is justice for the American people. If someone lied to us and got us into an unjust and unnecessary war, that demands justice. That does not just demand an indictment. It demands a conviction. It demands that the people doing the indictment do their homework, and they have these people dead to rights. Now, I'm one that thinks at this point, Fitzgerald, who, by the way, did you know he used to be a doorman in Brooklyn?
Really?
Yes, he was a doorman in Flatbush, Brooklyn, back in the day, before he got famous.
He is certainly not someone to be trifled with. I've been so impressed with the work he's been doing.
Well, yeah, and see, there's a big difference between doorman and doormat.
Yeah, that's right.
Patrick Fitzgerald is no one's doormat, all right? This guy is serious, and I think because of some of the things that we've been talking to, including our conversation yesterday with Larissa Alexandrovna from Raw Story, this thing is going to be a lot bigger when it's all said and done. And some of the people that we may think will be indicted may not be indicted, but I think he has pulled the rock up off a festering, moldy, fetid, stinking mess that has been the Bush administration's foreign policy, and we are going to sooner or later see some justice. He has also, by the way, been looking at some cases that are ongoing, have nothing to do with Plangate.
Right.
All right? So I think what he's looking at is the extent to which these people have gone. And remember, if anybody jumps up and says, well, he was only supposed to focus on a very narrow issue here, whether the blah, 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 blah act had been, remember something. Ken Starr was supposed to be focusing on something very narrow as well. And what did he end up doing?
That's right.
All right. So let's play fair here. Don't go for the hype. Don't go for the okie doke that he's only supposed to be looking at the identity. What is the name of that thing? The Identity Whatever It Is Act. By the way, only one person has been prosecuted under that act since 1982. This is much, much deeper than that.
And at this point, Mark, I'm almost I'm having to talk myself down from getting overly excited. John Crimmins and I were talking about that the other day. You know, just a few weeks ago, if you had told me Karl Rove is going to be indicted, I would have said, great, finally that little turd blossom is going to get what's been coming to him. That guy's such a piece of trash, and I want to see him go down. Well, now we've heard so much hype about how deep this thing goes that if it's anything less than Rove and Libby, I'll be disappointed, and there's a part of me that thinks that it could be so much bigger.
Hey, well, don't be disappointed. Even if only one of those two gets indicted, don't be disappointed, because the rock has been removed from a festering sore in the way this country does its business around the world, and that needed to be exposed, and it needs to be rectified, no matter who's indicted in this.
That's absolutely true, and I think that's what we need to keep reminding ourselves and others and our friends, people in your workplace, when you're having a debate over this, and they're telling you, oh, it's not a big deal. This is not just about a leak. This is about a conspiracy and a cover-up to hide and cover up the lies that took us into this war.
Absolutely.
That is what it's about.
We've got some more information about some more lying that apparently was going on.
Oh, man,
in terms
Roddy.
Of who told what to the grand jury. We're going to get to that. We've got a bunch of other stuff. We're going to be talking to Julia Tarver from the Center for Constitutional Rights about this Gitmo story. And, you know, we don't want to ruin anybody's breakfast, but we got to tell this because this is ugly as well. 16 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Mornings Edition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. It's Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is at the Osher Marin County JCC in San Rafael, California, tomorrow evening at 8 p.m., which means, of course, he's not here now because he went out to the West Coast. He's chilling, relaxing. And if you want tickets, if you're out in the San Francisco area, go to marinjcc.org. marinjcc.org. We've got some breaking news for you. The attorney for one of Saddam Hussein's co-defendants in his trial, who was kidnapped yesterday, has now been found dead. He was dumped near a Baghdad mosque. This is according to the Iraq Lawyers Union, and this was after talking to the man's family. I don't want to mispronounce his name, so I won't. But the man was found dead near Baghdad's Fardus Mosque. And he was killed. It is confirmed, according to the victim's family.
And this guy was kidnapped just yesterday evening.
Yeah.
And so whoever took him, and we still don't know exactly who is responsible for this, whoever did it is not messing around. And it was not about ransom or getting money. This was just about killing a guy and sending a message.
Absolutely. By the way, if you're waking up at 22 past the hour, and if you are in South Florida, get out now. Okay. They've evacuated 200,000 people in Cuba already, and it hasn't hit Cuba yet. Wow, what kind of FEMA do they got, huh?
Yeah, yeah, it's called Fidel.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the Cubans, by the way, I'm not just saying this to blow smoke. The Cubans actually are really good at evacuating for hurricanes. They're good at interdicting drugs, and they're really good at evacuating in the face of hurricanes. So maybe Michael Chertoff ought to give Fidel a call and find out, yo, what's up?
Yeah, I don't think that's happening anytime soon.
No time soon, but we can only hope.
Right.
Now, Judith Miller, you may remember her, reporter for the New York Times, big expose in the paper last Sunday. I believe it was Sunday.
Yeah.
Long thing, discourse about how, you know, her 85 days in jail. Did she do more time than Martha Stewart? Well, maybe around the same time as Martha Stewart. Who knows? But anyway, she's out now. And, she kind of did her little mea culpa. The Times did their mea culpa. And now we find out maybe she should have done a little bit more. It turns out that Judith Miller didn't tell Patrick Fitzgerald's grand jury about her June 23rd, 03 meeting with Scooter Libby until the Secret Service pulled her coat to the fact that they had logs of her presence at the White House. So, in other words, it seems like she was what's a nice four-letter word, a $4 word for lying? Obfuscating, perhaps? I don't know. Whatever it is, she wasn't telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth. I don't know if she's going to pay for it. I don't know if she'll end up being indicted in all of this. She's been released from any contempt charges by Patrick Fitzgerald in return for her testimony. But now you got to ask yourself, you know, exactly how good is her testimony? When she appeared on September 30th, when she first got out of the joint, she did not bring up this June 23rd meeting. Now, subsequent to that time, two things happened. One, they found a notebook in the Washington Bureau of the New York Times that apparently had Judy on it, and they opened it up and realized, hey, it's Judith Miller's notes.
Right.
And the other thing is, the Secret Service somehow got to her and said, hey, you know what? You were here. I wonder if you weren't talking to Scooter Libby, who were you talking to? And suddenly she said, whoa, I guess I was talking to Scooter Libby. Now, her lawyer, Bob Bennett, says her testimony is now, and I'm quoting here, correct, complete, and accurate. Now, I'm not a lawyer, okay? But I know what lawyers do with statements from people who say, now my testimony is correct, complete. Now they say, well, wait a minute. Were you lying before? You're lying now.
Right.
You know?
Well, here's my question for you, Riley. Is it's very clear from what we've seen and from the evidence that you just enumerated that Judy Miller was not being straight with Fitzgerald from the get-go, even after he released her from a contempt charge, even after she got out of jail. When she first testified, she was not being straight with him.
Okay.
My question for you is, what do you think her game is here? How much was she taken in by the administration, and how much is she in bed with the administration?
Here's two things that most reporters value over anything else, including their mother and father in most instances. One is access to power. The other is their reputation as a journalist. Judy Miller has apparently lost the latter. I don't know whether she's any more good to the New York Times or to to any other newspaper in the country.
She shouldn't be able to get a job with the National Enquirer, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, maybe they do have standards. You never know. But I'm going to tell you this right now. Judy Miller, I believe, went through this entire scenario. And I'm talking about from going back to her reporting on the on-ramp to the war. The whole thing about the aluminum tubes that they found and how they could only be used to create centrifuges to create a nuclear weapon. All of this reporting that she did, and by the way, standing down people in her own newsroom who questioned the veracity of what she was saying. There's one reason why reporters do that, and that is for access to the corridors of power. Reporters like to have people like Scooter Libby or somebody in the Clinton administration back in the day or somebody in Bush's daddy's administration way back in the day. They like to have people come to them and say, this is off the record, but that's what they like.
Right.
That's what they live for. That's what they do. That's how they're able to report all this sort of thing. And Judith Miller, I think, and I don't know the woman. You know, we had a couple people here the other day that apparently did, but I don't know her. But, I've seen this kind of thing happen before, and I've seen people get drunk, not just with power, but with access, with the ability to say, hey, I'm going to call Scooter Libby up on the phone, find out what's going on with this, and then taking what these people say as gospel and reporting it as fact. And what I think she's realizing now is that she's been... The hip-hop kids have a different way of putting this, and I'm not going to say it because it's kind of early in the morning and kids
are
listening.
Come on, say it.
All right. She's ass out, all right? That's what it is, okay? That's what her problem is, because the people that she depended on for this information were lying like rugs and playing her like a Stradivarius. But, hey, that's Judith Miller. We're going to come back with the iNews 5000. We're going to talk about this Guantanamo story where they're force-feeding prisoners with tubes. Stay with us. It's 27 past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is out in California doing a gig. He'll be back on Monday. I will be out on Monday. We'll be back together on Tuesday. Right now, we have got, I'm really impressed by the fact that we brought in major talent.
Major talent here.
Thank you very much.
Reporting Captain.
Okay, no problem. I'm Captain who?
I don't know. Yeah.
Who knows?
You're Doctor Who.
Anyway, Barry Lank is here because he's going to do the iNews 5000.
Thank you, Mark. Sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. So luckily, we have an iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's crank this up and feed it some headlines, shall we? From San Jose Mercury News, Senate committee demands more answers from Myers. Let's try that again. San Jose Mercury News. I'm learning the buttons, America.
Yeah, it's funny, Barry. Maron actually did that exactly.
Yeah, Maron did the exact same.
Well, that's the order the buttons are in, you see. Like, the second thing I do would be the second button.
Logic? You want logic?
Yeah. You'd think after nearly 2 years in this organization, I'd know better. Here we go. San Jose Mercury News. Senate committee demands more answers from Myers. Senate committee demands more answers from Myers. Translation. Senate committee expects better evasiveness from Myers. From Fox News. House votes to ban obesity lawsuits against fast food industry. House votes to ban obesity lawsuits against fast food industry. Translation, Kirstie Alley to dismiss her legal team. Ouch. Oh, why do we do that? Why the hurt? Ooh. From Associated Press, Michael Jackson. This I found interesting. Michael Jackson called for jury service. Michael Jackson called for jury service. Translation, court orders jury box equipped with treehouse.
Oh.
Here it is. The right button. That's it.
Nice work. Nice work.
Oh, thank you.
And worth every penny of waking you up at this time. I just want you to know that.
I demand my massage at 3 o'clock.
Thank you very much. My people will call your people. We'll have lunch. Now, we see now, and Barry talked a little bit about Harriet Myers. God, what an embarrassment this woman has turned out to be. A couple of weeks ago, I said I wasn't sure she was going to make it. Now I'm pretty sure she's not going to make it. She, according to Raw Story, has provided, quote, erroneous and incomplete information to the Senate Judiciary Committee about her membership on a board of directors for a real estate investment company. Now, this is hot on the heels of Armand Specter, a Republican, chair of the Judiciary Committee, and Patrick Leahy, senator from Vermont, Democrat, bipartisan, saying to Harriet Myers, essentially, hey, you know, you didn't finish your homework. Could you go home and finish it and bring it back, and let's see if we can make something out of all this? They said, essentially, she was incomplete with the answers that she gave. Now, let's ask ourselves a little question here, shall we, folks? How is someone that is up for the highest court in the land going to rectify doing a simple questionnaire? I mean, maybe it's a complicated questionnaire, but hey, she's not running for dog catcher here. She's running for, nominated for Supreme Court Justice. Even if it's a complicated questionnaire, you would think she'd be able to answer it in a full and complete manner to the satisfaction of both the Democratic and Republican sides of the committee that will judge her and judge her nomination. Apparently not. Now, I don't know, maybe she's just so enamored of George W. Bush that that's all she thinks about here. Maybe the answer to every question was, George W. Bush is a great man. I don't know. But there's something wrong here. There's something wrong with her nomination. And her nomination has unearthed something else. And I'm going to give credit where credit is due. Sometimes I do this against my better judgment because it really doesn't always make sense to say to people, hey, you know, you're on the right side of something, if they're on the wrong side of everything else. But there have been some conservatives who have stepped up to the plate and said what needed to be said about how this woman was nominated and why this woman was nominated. God help me, am I saying George Will and Charles Krauthammer and some of these other people who I ordinarily dismiss as a cabal of morons did the right thing this time?
Isn't it scary when that happens, Riley?
It is, but I got to tell you, I've seen this in my own life. I know some guys. I know some cops, okay? Now, believe it or not, me, and I used to be a real radical, okay? I used to be a borderline cop hater, okay? But I know cops. I've known cops throughout my life. And I know cops who are some of the most conservative people in the known universe, when it comes to fiscal matters, when it comes to their own, you know, how they handle their family business. They are very, very conservative people. Don't like to part with a dime for anything, okay? But they are also some of the most virulently anti-racist people I know. They will not tolerate, and I mean not tolerate for a minute, any form of what they perceive to be racism. And these are white ethnic police officers. I'm not talking about, you know, guys with dreadlocks or nothing.
Right.
All right. These are people who say, look, if the police or anybody else can act in a racist fashion toward a black person, then they can do it toward a Latino. They can do it toward an Italian American. They can do it toward anybody. And they don't tolerate that. And I like to think that maybe some of the ink that we've seen questioning Harriet Myers' nomination is in that same vein. I'm not sure that these guys are as likable as my friends are. But, I mean, you know, Krauthammer, well, I'm sure that it pained them to write what they have been writing and to say what they've been saying in the media about this woman's nomination. I don't see it being able to fly anymore, to be honest with you.
I think you're absolutely right, Riley, and you did call it several weeks ago, so people who listen to Morning Sedition heard it here, heard you express your doubts a while back. But I think that this is also really indicative of what is going on in terms of the leak investigation and in terms of guys, especially Karl Rove and Andy Card and Bush's minions being monopolized trying to fight this leak investigation.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that, the Myers thing has slid through the cracks.
Yeah.
There have been charges and countercharges about who's responsible for the rather sloppy manner in which Harriet Myers has been presented to the American people.
Well, Riley, think back to just a couple months ago when John Roberts was rolled out. That guy was rolled out like a perfect, sweet-smelling, neatly wrapped package. He had his kids and his wife ready for the photo op. They had the resume. They had the talking heads ready to be rolled out. They had the columns and editorials ready to be rolled out.
Yep.
They had a storyline and their talking points. It was
had a former actor doing the rolling.
And they had
Fred
Thompson to hold his hand and take him all around Capitol Hill. John Roberts was his nomination was approved 48 hours after he was nominated.
Yeah, well, you know
for
what?
For all intents and purposes.
Well, that was John Roberts was the Bentley to Harriet Myers Edsel,
right.
Apparently, because this is not working out for her.
But you see what happens when they don't have that machinery in place and the truth is allowed to rise to the surface.
Well, let's look at what has happened here. They rolled her out and they tried to say, well, she's an evangelical born-again Christian, to try and mollify the Christian conservatives who were not happy with her nomination. That did not work. Then they got criticism from the other side, people saying, wait a minute, you know, why is her religion such a big issue? Nod, nod, wink, wink,
right.
Okay? Now you see, earlier this week, they said, okay, we're going to roll her out as a competent jurist, someone who has, or a competent lawyer, she was never really a jurist, but a competent lawyer who has a deep background, who understands the issues, blah, 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 blah. And then that frame gets smacked around, in part, by a Republican, Arlen Specter, who said, well, wait a minute, she's not that competent. She couldn't even fill out our questionnaire, for God's sake. And now we see another report, again, from our friends at Raw Story, because I want to make sure we source them now. But Raw Story is saying, look, Harriet Myers lied on this on the application. It's not really a job application, but she lied in the questionnaire in terms of her role with this real estate company, which, by the way, was investigated and charged with some malfeasance but not found guilty. We should say that in fairness.
Right.
It was not a question of that. But apparently, much like Judith Miller, Harriet Myers had a little bit of a lapse in – is that what they're going to call it, a lapse in memory? I mean, I don't know. What is it?
If she was the if she had the pre-existing package that John Roberts had in terms of everything, you know, the neatly wrapped package with all of the machinery ready to go, and then this little stumble came up with a questionnaire, they could get past it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, as you have said, Riley, I really think that it's really kind of a stake in the heart.
I think it may be the last straw. Now, speaking of last straws, and I hate to make this kind of segue because it's going to sound macabre, but they have been ramming feeding tubes down the throats of hunger strikers at Guantanamo Naval Base.
Reportedly dirty feeding tubes,
yeah. Now, there is a conundrum that people face here, okay? If people are on a hunger strike, if you're not careful, they will die on you. So if you are determined to keep them alive, you have to find a way to get them sustenance. That's pretty much natural. That's been true of hunger strikes in whether it's in Northern Ireland or in Cuba. But, you know, to take allegedly dirty feeding tubes, and we'll get into this with our next guest, Julia Tarver from the Center for Constitutional Rights, to take dirty feeding tubes, to take a feeding tube out of the mouth of one detainee and shove it into the mouth of another after the first detainee has vomited blood into it. Sorry about that, you breakfast folks.
Yeah.
You know, that is torture. That is malfeasance. And, of course, the military has reacted in the way they typically react. We take care of everyone here at Guantanamo. We run a clean base. Nobody's doing anything wrong. You are stepping on the great work of the people that are there. Now, it's a given. A lot of the people that are working at Guantanamo are working under less than ideal circumstances. And some of the people who are detained at Guantanamo are not great people. They're not people you'd want to have over for lunch, okay? Let's be real about that.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that is where there is something wrong being done, you cannot hide it. You should not attempt to hide it. You shouldn't try and brush it over. You shouldn't cover it up. If you have detainees who are on a hunger strike, there is no excuse, and I mean no excuse, for taking a dirty feeding tube out of one person's mouth and sticking it in the mouth of the other.
Well, I think, Mark, you know, one thing that a lot of people have dismissed this whole torture story with is to say, well, these people would do it to our guys. You know, they're beheading people, so why shouldn't we do it to them? And the reason is because it's un-American.
Yep.
and because we're supposed to be better than them.
Exactly. We are supposed to be better. Isn't that why we invaded? Wasn't it to bring our democracy,
right,
our goodness,
and this,
to another country?
This cuts right to the fundamental core of what it means to be American. Okay, our Constitution, our government is based on the notion that all human beings, by virtue of being human beings, have basic rights and freedoms.
Yep.
That is the founding principle of our nation. And to torture people in a prison goes against that fundamental notion, and it is therefore un-American. And we're going to get into that in more detail in our next segment.
Absolutely. And see, if you're faced with this kind of problem, the American way is to find a solution that does not involve torture. We're going to be talking with Julia Tarver from the Center for Constitutional Rights, who has represented some of these detainees. Coming up next on Air America Radio, it's 46 minutes past the hour.
You know, whoever f***ing with this phone system can f*** themselves in the mouth and eat their own waste. You know, that's what I say. So leave me alone. I'm trying to get a good take and replay it back on my touch-tone pad. So can I play and get a good recording so I can hear how it sounds? I got an inconsistent mental disposition.
Next message.
Morning Sedition. On Air America Radio.
One minute past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. If you're just waking up, Mark Maron has not been fired. He's out in California. He's going to be at the Asher Marin County JCC in San Rafael tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock. For tickets, go to marinjcc.org. Coming up, we've got Johnny K Street. We've got Cliff Notes. We've got Vanity Fair's Michael Wolf and a whole lot more. But right now, in spite of a torture scandal over a year ago that shocked the world and inflamed Muslim animosity toward the United States, a mountain of evidence shows that policies at Guantanamo have not changed significantly. Our next guest is a partner with Paul Weiss, Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison, LLP, and is one of the leading habeas corpus attorneys with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Her firm represents 10 Saudi detainees at Guantanamo, several of whom are now on hunger strike. Julia Tarver joins us this morning by telephone. Good morning, Julia. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Let me ask you first and foremost, we talked in a very skeletal fashion about some of the things that detainees have been forced to accept at Guantanamo. You've been there. You've talked to these detainees. Exactly what kind of treatment are they being subjected to?
Well, from what we heard on our most recent trip, the treatment is something you would just never dream in a million years could happen at a U.S. facility. The detainees are being subjected to riot guards coming in and forcibly injecting and removing these feeding tubes up through their noses and down and into their stomachs and reusing the same tubes to another detainee. The treatment there is worse than you would expect to see even compared to raid.
Wow. Now, let me get this straight, because is it the guards that are inserting and removing these tubes, or is it doctors? I thought doctors were supposed to do that.
Well, that is the irony of the situation, unfortunately, because doctors, we were told, are actually standing by and observing this treatment. But we were told that on more than one occasion, the guards come in as a way to supposedly stop the clients from participating in the hunger strike. The guards are involved by inserting and removing these tubes in our clients' noses.
Julia Tarver, how should not just the staff at Guantanamo, but the doctors as well? I mean, if they're faced with people who are on a hunger strike, who may, by continuing the strike, endanger their lives, what should they be doing?
Well, we've encouraged them repeatedly, if their true goal is to stop the risk that someone down there is going to die on their watch, which would be a PR disaster, they know. If their true goal is to stop these folks from a hunger strike, then they should involve counsel for these clients. They should involve their families. They should be providing somewhat more of an environment that would be conducive to that, to give medical advice, to give psychological counseling. I think their only tactic is force. And that simply is not a force that is going to be make a positive effect when you're trying to persuade someone to discontinue a hunger strike.
Now, Julia, I'd like to put this in context, if we could, very briefly. We've talked to people who have been guards down at Gitmo, and they say, look, there are some bad people down here, but exactly what have the people who are being detained at Guantanamo, what have they been accused of, tried for, convicted of?
Sadly, they haven't been accused, tried, or convicted of anything at this point. What they've been subjected to for 4.5 years is a detention at a facility where there has been a blanket designation by President Bush that they are all enemy combatants. And some of them have participated, most have not, in what's referred to as combatant status review tribunals, where the military, usually without the client being present, makes a determination that the determination previously made in a blanket fashion by President Bush was correct. Even under that sort of a kangaroo court system, many, many people at Guantanamo, after years at this place, have been released. I don't think we as Americans can have any confidence that that process is doing what it's supposed to do in terms of finding out who really has any link whatsoever to terrorism.
Now, there was a hearing on the treatment of prisoners at Guantanamo last week in the nation's capital here in Washington, not here, but in Washington, D.C. How did that go, and when do you expect a ruling on that?
Well, we had a ruling in front of Judge Kessler, and I think the hearing went very well. She heard the parties for an extended period of time. She put some tough questions to the government. She insisted that the government file some sort of response to the allegations, despite the fact they felt they were too busy doing everything else they were doing at Guantanamo to spare the time to prepare a response to the allegations. They did file a response yesterday. And we hope that Judge Kessler will give us a ruling sometime this week or early next.
Are you optimistic that the policy can be changed?
Well, you know, being a lawyer on these Guantanamo cases has taken away a little bit of my optimism about how the process should work. It's really an Alice in Wonderland type system. But I have every confidence that Judge Kessler will do the right thing.
Julia Tarver, thank you so much for being with us. You know, the media hasn't really covered this nearly as much as it should, and we're going to check back in with you so that we can keep abreast of what's going on here.
Please do. I'd really appreciate it.
All right. We appreciate you being with us. Julia Tarver, and she is an attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. She's the leading habeas corpus attorney there, and she's also an attorney with the law firm, partner with the law firm of Paul Weiss, Rifkind, Wharton, and Garrison, LLP. Get your bets ready. Get your money down. Johnny K Street is on his way in. We'll be talking with him. We'll be talking with Vanity Fair's Michael Wolff about Dick Cheney, the where's, why's, and wherefore art thou, Dick? At any rate, this is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. Six minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Reilly. Mark Maron is out on the West Coast having himself a great deal of... No, actually, he's probably asleep. But he's going to have a great deal of fun over the next couple of days because he's doing a gig out in Marin County on tomorrow evening. Want to say a special good morning to all the bloggers, to all the people streaming us at airamericaradio.com around the world. All our XM satellite radio listeners want to say good morning to doctors, to lawyers, especially to dentists, because I went to one yesterday, my good friend Dr. Blair. Want to say good morning to bankers and captains of industry, especially those who love lap dancers, and to the good people of Asheville, North Carolina, because I'll be going down there later on today. Special good morning to the clergy who work and live for peace. Good morning to people who are not affiliated with any political party, but who vote anyway. And a special good morning to my good friend Rachel Maddow, host of The Rachel Maddow Show.
Hi, Mark Reilly.
How you doing?
I'm happy to see you. I'm happy it's Friday.
And you're happy it's Friday. Usually you're winging your way home to some well-deserved crash time about now.
That's right.
But
I know.
We thank you for sticking with us.
No problem. It's a delight to be here. What are you going to Asheville for?
A wedding, actually.
Yours?
No, you? I've been married already, unless my wife divorced me last evening. That's possible, but no. No, I'm going to going for the wedding of her first cousin.
Oh.
It was at this place called the Biltmore Estate. It's a big place down there. I don't know.
Swanky.
Swanky, I guess. Yeah, I know. I'll have the out cottage for a room. But anyway, you know, I mentioned last hour that we paid one of our highest paid talents, Barry Lank, good money to come in here early this morning. And he is here this morning with...
That's funny.
Well, why? Hi, Barry.
The highest paid part.
Who's
writing your material
we
now?
We pay
that's
him
good.
In paper clips.
Oh, in paper clips. Okay.
More than anybody.
All right, well, we gave him five extra
of them.
To come in at the break of dawn this morning. Mm-hmm. And he's got something for us, Barry. What you got?
Well, though, for those who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's morning's edition, Cliff Notes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Cue the music. Okay, if you say so. A congressional investigation reveals that Army National Guard units in the U.S. are short of vital equipment like Humvees because they had to leave it in Iraq for replacement troops. The Pennsylvania Guard had to leave behind so much equipment that the state had to borrow supplies from the Amish Guardsmen, including several hundred non-machine guns.
That's right.
The good news is that Iraq is perfectly prepared for a hurricane in Florida. A Walmart heiress has lost her USC diploma after her college roommate revealed the heiress paid her to do her papers and assignments. Paige Laurie recently gave her diploma back to the university. Okay, she paid someone else to give it back, but that still counts, right? The heiress paid her roommate $20,000 to do her homework until she found out several Chinese students would do it for a quarter of the price. Oh, yeah. Chinese police, speaking of China, Chinese police are investigating reports of attempts to sell babies on eBay's Chinese website. What baffles law enforcement officials the most is that, unlike other collectibles on eBay, the babies don't retain their value.
Oh, God.
Already, the U.S. government has filed a complaint with China for selling cheap knockoffs of more expensive American babies. And those, ladies and gentlemen, are your morning's edition clip notes for now.
Barry Link!
Very nice, Barry. Oh, nice job. Nice
oh,
work.
God, love you.
Yeah. So much for that. Anyway, thanks a lot. I appreciate you coming back, right?
Yeah, I'm coming back at
8:55.
Oh, okay. And I'll sit here for now and just soak
and
in
just
Rachel's
chill.
Warmth.
There you go.
I brought my warmth.
We never see each other anymore.
Wow. Yeah. Sounds like a never mind.
Riley, you might need to step out of the studio.
I know.
Do we have like kind of like tampon commercial music that we can play like romantic?
Yeah, we can
music
run through a field nice. Together and
tampon commercial
music. And then we're, wait a minute. How about this?
And then it's me and Rachel horseback riding, swimming in a public pool.
Wearing white.
Uh-oh. Oh, my God.
Oh, I haven't worn white in quite a while, Rachel.
Anyway.
Here now, the news. No, listen, you guys, you're all right with me, though.
Sorry.
Absolutely. Listen, you know, the story that you just did about the National Guard is a striking story. Because it kind of rounds out something that I've heard. I know Rachel has reported on this as well.
Yeah.
You know, the people who sent our troops over to Iraq did so and continue to do so in the name of democracy. They continue to laud the troops, their contribution, their sacrifice, and all this. And yet we see at virtually every turn, this administration doing something to slap these folks in the head as they serve or as they come home. The latest is that there are Army National Guard units across the country, particularly in the state of Pennsylvania, which has an awful lot of National Guardsmen over in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that when they sent the equipment over there along with the troops, they left the equipment there. That's absurd. It's insane.
And it's because they don't have plans. One of the things that they're leaving behind is armored vehicles, right?
Yeah.
Because armored vehicles, they really need those in Iraq, and there still isn't a plan to get all the armored vehicles that the troops in Iraq need over there, so they can't let any of them come back, even though that's the way that military planning works. When the National Guard and Reserve troops go over there, they bring all their own equipment, and then they're supposed to bring it back with them so they can use it in national defense and national disaster preparedness stuff.
Emergencies!
But they can't leave it. And so they're giving their radios over, their night vision goggles, their armored vehicles, their helicopters, all this stuff that in the plan they would bring home with them and be able to use here in responding, say, to Hurricane Wilma, has to stay over there. And it's, just, yeah. It's ridiculous. The lack of planning, the idea that Donald Rumsfeld was going to somehow slim down the military because his planning was going to be so good. Come on.
Well, yeah, it's insane. And it's also insane to think that as the equipment that is here is replaced, you've got people inside the National Guard, some of the top brass in the National Guard, saying, hey, this is inferior equipment to the stuff we sent over there.
Yeah.
Well, if they were planning ahead, they wouldn't have been using the reserve troops.
Well,
in the first place.
Exactly. Hey, stop quibbling, all right?
Well, and bear in mind that the war in Iraq was supposedly the thing that was going to make all of us safer. Yet, meanwhile, we're not even safe from a hurricane because our defenses are weakened. And not only are our defenses weakened, but that weakness is on display for all the world to see.
Yeah.
Wait, let me get something straight. We're against Bush in this place?
That's exactly
the point. Oh, God, I'm sorry. I'm in the wrong.
I forgot to give you the memo this morning,
Barry. I got to quit now.
Yeah. Now, here's shaft number two. And we talked about this, or actually, the story came out earlier this week. You know, the National Guard and Army Reserve had been promised a $15,000 per person bonus if they read up, which is to sign up, re-enlist for another 6 years. Well, you know what? Not only has no one gotten the bonus, the Pentagon has taken the bonus off the table.
I'm curious. I saw that story. Can people now renege on reing up? Can they say, you know, you didn't fill in the contract?
Sure. Here's a blindfold. Step by that wall over there.
It's a contract. I'm reeing up for $15,000. You don't give me my $15,000. You broke the contract.
I wonder if that 15 G's was in the contract.
I mean, think about what's happening in terms of recruiting, right? It's kind of like with prison populations. Like, you think that what determines how big your prison population is how many people you're sending to jail? It's not. It's how many people you're letting out. That actually affects the prison population much more. It's the same thing with the Army. What affects the size of the Army, the number of troops that we've got, more than anything, is whether or not people leave at the end of the time they sign up for. Especially now.
Yeah.
And so you think about the planning, the fact that nobody in their right mind wants to sign up to be in the military if they've never been in it before now because of what they know they're getting into. And then you think, okay, we got to pay people $15,000 in order to re-up, and we're extending the sign-up bonus by $10,000 and $20,000 and $30,000 and $40,000 in some cases. Wait a minute. This is real money.
Yep.
This is part of the Pentagon's budget. This is part of the bad planning. Even if they hadn't taken this thing off the table, it shows you how bad the planning is that they even had to offer that. How can that possibly not break the bank?
So this is a layer of bad planning on top of another layer of bad planning,
exactly.
You seem to be saying.
You're throwing good money after bad, and they just, I mean, the amount of money that's being spent in Iraq, the fact that the Pentagon took all of their inspectors general out of Iraq, and so all military spending in Iraq isn't being audited at all. We're just throwing money at a badly planned war with more bad planning.
You know, they could have paid for all of these bonuses if they had gotten some of that money that Alawi's government apparently stole, because they got arrest warrants out for them to the tune of $1 billion.
To the tune of $1 billion.
Now, I would think, you could get people to re-up. Now, by the way, this is the National Guard and Army Reserve is facing the most severe recruiting crisis in a generation.
Mm-hmm.
Not since Vietnam have they had so much trouble getting people to go into the armed forces. I mean, they have swag, for God's sake. You know, they give you hats, they give you this, they give you that.
Then apparently they take them back.
Yeah, they give you the latest Kanye West CD if you sign up. I don't know what it is that they're thinking about, but they are hitting, and it's interesting that they're hitting areas like Pennsylvania, places like New Mexico and other areas, particularly in rural parts of America.
Well, that's always been where people volunteer. You know, Southerners and folks and farm boys are the traditional stock of people who join the Army.
They look for people who have no other option.
Well, there's that, too. That's how they get folks from the city.
Yeah, you know, Jim Earl's looking for an apartment. Maybe he ought to enlist.
Oh, my God.
The barracks are nice.
He would nag the insurgents to death.
They have never had a larger proportion of guardsmen and reservists in the active combat force than we've had in this war. We've got half of the force in Iraq right now is guardsmen and reservists.
And reserves, which is ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous because it does take away, and it took away during Katrina and Rita. It took away from the military's ability to respond to disaster. Now, that doesn't mean that the military responds to disaster by going out and shooting people. That's not what I'm saying. The military actually does play a role, you know, a role in terms of trying to get supplies to people, to try and put a human face on, you know, in an unmitigated disaster in the case of Katrina.
Well, sandbags, you know, like sandbags, that's usually guys in green uniforms filling up the sandbags, either that or prisoners.
As a matter of fact, they're not really... That's not their main. Their main training is not going around killing people. It's going around saving people, which is what puts them in an awkward position.
Yeah, it is called the Army Corps of Engineers.
After all. That's exactly right.
Barry Lank, Rachel Maddow, thank you both so much.
Thanks, Mr. Riley.
Appreciate you being here this morning. Happy Friday. It's 17 minutes past the hour. And Johnny K Street, I hear his heavy footsteps as we speak. Stay with us. It's Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com, Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is in California. He'll be back on Monday. We'll be back together on Tuesday. We know where Hurricane Wilma's going. We don't know where Dick Cheney is. We'll talk about that with Michael Wolff, Vanity Fair editor, coming up. But right now, there are a lot of big stories in the news this week. So let's get some bets down with our own Inside the Beltway odd... Beltway odds maker, Johnny K Street.
All right, baby.
Johnny, where's the action?
It follows me, baby. Hey, where's Maron?
He's working in San Francisco at a comedy club.
No kidding. So does he do that, hey, did you ever do this or that or see that thing? Me too, but to me it was funny. You know, that kind of stuff.
I don't think he does that kind of comedy.
You know who I love? The guy with the big trunk and all the crazy props. He kills me. What the heck is his name?
You mean Carrot Top?
Rip Taylor with the confetti and the funny boy. Now that's comedy.
Hey, Johnny, what kind of action we're looking at this week?
Tom DeLay, baby! He finally got booked and fingerprinted. Did you see DeLay's mugshot? I haven't seen someone that happy about a booking since Jay Leno had Hugh Grant on The Tonight Show. I was glad to see Rome get caught. I haven't enjoyed watching someone get nailed that much since that party at Heidi Fleiss's in 92. DeLay might be smiling now, but if he has to go bye-bye for a while, I guarantee he starts crying like a little girl.
Johnny, I'll take that one for 100.
Yeah, man, put me down for 50.
All right, Riley and Pashman the Cashman, down and down.
What about Karl Rove, Johnny?
Karl Rove is going down, baby, and I haven't enjoyed watching someone go down that much since that party at Heidi.
Oh, hey, Johnny, do you think Rove will get indicted?
Guaranteed, no matter how he tries to squirm out of it. Rove has already given up Scooter Libby. He's squealing like a little pig. You know what we call guys like Rove? Missing. I'll give you even money, Rove gets indicted. You could make easier money if you were betting that Harriet Myers leads when she dances, if you get my drift. You might as well just stick a gun in my back and rob me.
Well, put me down for 500, Johnny.
Yeah, give me a C-note's worth.
All right. You're down.
Johnny, have you been watching the Saddam Hussein trial?
When you say trial, it sounds like there's a chance he might be found innocent. They're going to shoot Hussein full of more juice than Jose Canseco. It's ironic when you think about it. A lot of people in Iraq don't have electricity, but Hussein's is going to get all that he can handle and then some. If you want a long shot, I'll give you a million to one Hussein beats the rap.
No, no, no. Forget it. No way.
Smart man.
Hey, give me 50.
You're better off buying $50 worth of lottery tickets, kid. Believe me, only a real sucker would take a bet like that.
Hey.
That's the type of bet I would expect Maron to take. He's the kind of guy that wakes up in the morning and bets you he's still asleep. He's got a problem. Which brings me to my next subject, if I may.
Well, you're among friends, Johnny.
Thank you. You know, folks, gambling is big, big business. And for some people, it's a big, big problem. That's why I invented the Johnny K Street Control Your Gambling System. The Johnny K Street Control Your Gambling System is guaranteed to work. And if you don't believe me, I'll give you 50 to 1 on it.
Hey, Johnny, did you say the Control Your Gambling System? Are you actually trying to get people to stop gambling?
No, because that would be crazy. I'm trying to get people to control their gambling. What I'm saying is if you want to gamble, gamble. Just don't gamble as much. But hey, it's your business. Do what you want. Who am I to say?
Yeah, that's quite a system, Johnny. This wouldn't have anything to do with your community service, would it?
Any arrangement between myself and the court has to remain strictly confidential. Before I go, I just want to say a special thank you to a fan of mine, if that's okay. Her name is Penelope Richardson. She sent me a nice gift courtesy of your show.
What did your girlfriend think of that one, Johnny?
You mean my ex-girlfriend, Darlene? Johnny K is single again, baby. And if anyone is looking to fill that vacancy, they know how to contact me.
Hey, what happened to your ex, Johnny?
She got behind on her vig and she skipped town. It happens. I'm out of here. I got to get to court.
All right, man. Thank you very much. The great Johnny K Street coming through this morning. And I got my bets down. Pashman, you did too, huh?
I did, although he was insulting me. I mean, I think a million to one that Saddam's going to be innocent. I mean, that's worth $50. I'll be set for life if I win that bet.
Yeah, I know, but I can hear the trap door going now as we speak as far as Saddam is concerned.
Yeah.
You know, we really don't know exactly what Dick Cheney's role is in this whole plane gate thing. It may end up being as simple as indictee. I mean, that could end up happening, although I'm not sure a lot of people would put money down on his going down.
Yeah.
His boy, Scooter Libby, however, looks like he's on the train along with Karl Rove and a few other folks. But Dick Cheney has not been the visible, vigorous presence in the Bush presidency lately that he has been in the past. Remember, it was just a few years ago he was making trips out to Langley to harangue the CIA into, you know, ramping up the war in Iraq. Now he can't even attend a nice conservative dinner. We're going to find out why. Because Vanity Fair editor Michael Wolff has a big piece in the November issue about Dick Cheney's profound absence from the scene and what may be happening. We're going to be talking to Michael coming up next on Air America Radio. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is in California. He'll be back on Monday. We'll be back together on Tuesday. Stay tuned. Cardinal Milvington's in the house, and we're going to have Rapture Watch coming up. But right now, where in God's name is Dick Cheney? Given that the only place we've seen him recently live and in the flesh is on Fox News with Brit Hume last week, some would say that he's curled up in a hole somewhere. Not likely, says our next guest. Michael Wolff is a contributing editor with Vanity Fair magazine. In the November issue, he raises a few interesting hypotheses as to exactly what Cheney is up to these days. Michael Wolff joins us in studio this morning to talk about meanwhile in an undisclosed location. Michael, good morning.
How are you, Mark?
All right, how you doing?
I'm good.
Now, you wrote this during a time when Dick Cheney was, clearly not visible. I mean, he was at some usual dinners, conservative dinners that he would ordinarily have attended. He wasn't there all of a sudden.
No, I mean, the only time as I wrote this, he did appear in New Orleans, but he appeared in such a grumpy fashion.
That surprised you, obviously.
He was not there out of enthusiasm or on his own volition.
Volition, yeah. What do you think is happening with the guy? Why is he seemingly taking such a backseat role at what seems to be a very crucial time for the administration?
Well, I mean, I think you have to kind of enlarge this picture. Cheney is a really interesting figure. And what Cheney goes to, the issue of Cheney, is that this administration is really a different kettle of fish. There's never been a vice president like him.
Yes.
He is, and you kind of strain for the language here. What is he? He's running the show. George Bush is the roles they've carved is Bush as the front man, and Cheney is the executive back at headquarters, literally running things. And the thing to run, the biggest thing to run in this administration is Iraq. And I have no doubt that while we don't see Dick, that's what he's doing.
He's running Iraq?
This is his war.
He hasn't done a great job up until now.
I'm speechless because it's absolutely true. On the other hand, it may be that he's done an absolutely splendid job, a terrific job from his point of view. You have to ask, what has he wanted out of Iraq?
But wait a minute, Michael Brown thought he did a wonderful job from his point of view. Not everyone agreed.
I don't think that he did.
Really?
I think he was, or if he did, he was the only one thinking that. I mean, remember, Cheney got into office. I mean, they came into office, and I'm sure Cheney had one thing. I want to be in the White House. I want to be the vice president. I want to be George Bush's vice president because I want to deal with this Iraq situation, which has really been bothering me since the last time I was close to the White House. And so what are we going to do about Iraq? And he seethes about this, and he tries to figure this out, and then suddenly 9/11 comes. And he joins together two disparate events, 9/11 and Iraq. They really have nothing to do with each other. Nevertheless, Dick Cheney and this whole group in the White House who's concentrated around Iraq puts them together, literally puts them together. This is, you know, the WMD thing is the thing that joins them.
Now, we're talking about people like Libby and Feith, perhaps, and Wolfowitz, and some of the people that were there at the time. Many of them are not there now.
Well, even I'm not even sure, was Wolfowitz part of this group, which is literally right now, today, under investigation? The group is Cheney, it's Libby, it's Mary Matlin.
The White House Iraq group.
Right. It's a guy by the named Jim Wilkinson. It's it's Condi Rice.
Yeah.
It's the center of the Bush administration, the center of the Bush government, which Cheney is running.
Now, what is the relationship between Rice and Cheney? I've heard that they're not the best of friends all the time. You obviously say that they're acting in concert. How close are they?
Well, when I've had dinner with them.
I knew you did. No.
I don't know. I have no idea. I mean, I think obviously Condi Rice has carved this very interesting relationship and powerful relationship with Bush. And obviously Cheney has this powerful relationship with Bush, but that's perhaps looking at this as in a traditional hierarchical fashion.
Mm-hmm.
All power flows from the president, where I'm not sure that's true in this administration. Yeah, you know, a substantial amount of power, more than I think we've ever seen in any administration, flows directly from the vice president.
Yeah.
So what does where does Condi come in on that? I don't know. I mean, I actually my gut call is that Dick's in charge, and everybody knows that Dick's in charge.
Now let's look at two things that have obviously had an impact on Dick Cheney's life. One is his health, but which some people say has not been all that great. Maybe that's why he hasn't been around all that much. And of course, this leak probe, which is ongoing and has got to be troubling for him. Which of the two, if either of the two, do you think might explain some of his behavior recently in terms of not being around all that much?
Well, even here, I would step back, and I would say he's not around all that much because he doesn't want to be around. Because, you know, the interesting other thing about Dick Cheney is not only all this power that he has, but he's not really a politician. He doesn't like to do the political thing. As a matter of fact, that's... I kind of helplessly find myself thinking fondly of him.
Oh, my God.
Because he's not a politician.
But he's been in Congress. I mean, he's run for office. He's won. Doesn't that define him as a politician?
No, I don't think. I suppose. I mean, he's a Washington guy. I think that's what he is by profession. But the guy who wants you to make you feel good, the guy who wants to, and I don't think Dick Cheney has ever made anyone feel good, the guy who wants to, the guy who will say anything to get elected. It's an interesting thing about Dick Cheney that he won't say anything. I mean, he really, there's a guy who basically sticks to his guns, basically says, I don't care about you. We're going to do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
Oddly, it's kind of refreshing.
It is?
Sure.
Even if he's wrong.
Well, no, I mean it's devastating, and in the end you die.
Mm-hmm.
But along the way, I think you say, and I think a lot of people have responded to him this way. You say, okay, that's not a guy who's gonna sell me anything that I don't want. Now, in fact, he has. It's kind of this reverse salesmanship, and he sold you Iraq. But it's not that political thing. You know, it's not I am a phony. Nobody looks at Dick and says, I am a phony. You look at Dick and you say, okay, that's what you get. You know, a guy who's going to do what he wants to do, who's going to do what's best for him, for Halliburton, for whatever, but without that kind of sense that he's trying to pull this over on you. He is... What you see is what you get.
But does that mean that in terms of the run-up to the war and all of this intelligence management and all of the things that he seems to have been involved with, was he delusional? Did he really think he was right?
Sure. Absolutely he thought he was right. Absolutely. He got into this job and I think was single-minded about it. I want to do something about Iraq.
Did Saddam do something to his family or something? I mean, that kind of single-mindedness.
To find out the reason that they embarked on this at best quixotic adventure, at best, I don't know why. I mean, I literally have been over this. What could possibly be the rationale for this? And the only thing that you can kind of come up with is that it's so bizarre that there must be a rationale at some point. I mean, in this actually, you know, with this whole investigation going on now, with these whole indictments that we're at the edge of our seats waiting for, I think this is going to begin to go back here. And I think what we're going to go back to exactly is why are we in Iraq? And I think that there's probably an answer or a set of answers of which Dick Cheney is right at the center.
Is he going down?
You know, everyone, this is what I will leave the studio and I'll get on the phone, because it's all anyone who I know in the media business and the political business is talking about. And at this moment, nobody knows the answer, but it's the interesting thing is that he very well could go down, this entire administration. And you wouldn't have said this 2 weeks ago, and you certainly wouldn't have said this 2 weeks before that. Mm-hmm. So this is all moving at this incredible and ferocious rate that we've arrived at the brink. Everybody could go down.
But now, you talk to a lot of people. You just admitted. You speak to a lot of people. When you leave here, you're going to be speaking to a lot of people. What do they think about Cheney's chances here? Is he going to be firewalled between him and Scooter Libby, something that apparently hasn't happened yet? It seems like conventional wisdom is saying Scooter Libby's going to get indicted. So what are people telling you about how that's going to impact
you? Well, nobody knows. I mean, everybody is telling me everything, as a matter of fact, and I often find that when I speak to people, it turns out that they've spoken to other people who I've spoken to, so that they are merely repeating back to me rumors that I myself have started.
really? That is really candid of you to say.
So I don't know, and nobody does. I mean, we're in one of these situations again where, you know, the fate of nations is in the hands of a special prosecutor, which makes you think, don't these people ever learn? But this special prosecutor is quite interesting because there are very few leaks out of his office.
Yeah.
So the answer is that nobody knows. The other answer is that everybody suspects or wishes. It's hard to tell the difference there. That lots of people could be swept up in this, and that in fact Dick Cheney himself could be swept up in this.
The name of the article, Meanwhile in an Undisclosed Location. You know, you do a really good job on Patrick Fitzgerald, you know. I mean, if you decided to go back and start looking, you know, you used to be a doorman in Brooklyn.
A doorman in Brooklyn.
A doorman in Flatbush.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Now, does that make us feel good about things or not good?
As New Yorkers, I guess you got to feel pretty good. But anyway, Meanwhile in an Undisclosed Location appears in the November issue of Vanity Fair, which is on newsstands now as we speak.
On the stands, yes.
Michael Wolff, always great to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us. Stay with us. We have got Rapture Watch. Cardinal Milfington has gotten his huge hat in the building. He'll be with us next on Air America Radio. It's 46 minutes past the hour.
Morning Sedition.
It's just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Oh,
50 minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Notice how they get all the old music up in here, the Rockford Files theme. Half of these people in the booth over here weren't even born when the Rockford Files were on.
I don't know what that is.
That's James Garner, the Rockford Files theme, yo.
Yeah, what is that? Is that the Family Guy?
The Family Guy. Uh-oh. Wow, you guys are young. You're scared. Listen, apparently Cardinal Milfington has been called to the Vatican, and we're not exactly sure why, but...
Again?
Yeah, he's been called to the Vatican, apparently. I don't know if he's being called on the carpet or what the problem is, but... Hopefully he'll be with us next week.
Yeah.
But
we do apologize to those listeners who are looking forward to
Rapture Watch.
He won't be here today, but all the Milfingtons will be back next week.
Next week. They better be.
Or maybe the rapture is upon us.
Oh, no, not that. No, the rapture's not. Well, you know, there are people that are saying all these hurricanes mean that the rapture is upon us.
I think if the rapture were upon us, the good Cardinal Milfington would probably be one of the first to know.
Yeah, and that's why he's not here. He's on a ticket somewhere else.
Somewhere else, yeah. I'm not sure he'd share with us if the rapture was upon us.
Oh, my eye doesn't work.
Oh, man. Hey, get a spine, pal. Oh, only kidding. Hopefully. Your trip to the Vatican will be fine. Now, Wilma is getting closer. It's getting closer to landfall. Apparently, the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico is getting hammered even before it makes landfall. So, southern Florida, you could well be next. Although, the Miami papers are saying it may be weaker by the time it gets to South Florida. But I think it may cover a larger swath of South Florida as we look at the maps. Now, you know, those of you who don't live in New York City, you all don't know what you're missing. This is a great town. And it's a great town because you can do stupid stuff here that you can't do anywhere else in America. To wit, a guy who blew $240,000 at a strip club and then stiffed American Express on his bill, which means his credit is ruined until he steps into his grave. He says that the bill was padded by more than one of the club's busty beauties, according to a lawsuit. Now, how anyone, I don't care whether they've, you know, busty, filled with whatever, saline, whatever.
Right.
$241,000.
How many lap dances did they say he was charged for, Riley?
Let me see. How many? Wow, 50,000. I'm not sure how many lap dances.
I remember one of those guys from Scores being charged for 350 lap dances.
350 lap dances, which means he didn't have much lap left when it was all done. I'll tell you that.
He was just ass at the end of that.
He told his wife that someone stole his credit card.
Yeah, right. Now here's this guy. So everybody knows who he is. So if you ever hear of anybody trying to sell this product, you know what the deal is. It's called Savvis Communications, S-A-V-V-I-S. He is the chief executive, Robert McCormick. He's from Missouri, and he charged this thing 2 years ago, apparently, going to Scores. Now, for those of you who don't know about Scores, Scores is a strip club that is allegedly mobbed up, okay? Junior Gotti, at some point, allegedly had something to do with Scores, but that has nothing to do with the 241 G's this schmuck dropped some lap dances. But at any rate, he's suing, and American Express is suing Savvis and McCormick. And by the way, a condo and a Ferrari is about what you could buy with this $240,000 tab that the guy ran up. His wife is standing by his side.
Oh, man.
Saying he's a victim of, you know, a fraud. He couldn't deny the lap dances, couldn't deny he was at Scores. But this, to me, speaks to a larger truth, ladies and gentlemen. Because, you know, people a lot of times, you know, communications executives, corporate executives, you know, the masters of the universe of our great country, oft times look down their noses at, you know, ordinary people in the world.
And strippers.
But ordinary people don't run up $250,000 tabs anywhere, okay? Anywhere. They may run up that much of a tab to buy a house or something, but ordinary people do not do this. People with money do this. And if you think this guy McCormick was the first to get taken at Scores, you'd be absolutely wrong. In May 2004, an insurance executive by the name of Mitchell Blazer filed suit after being handed a bill for $28,000. Scores said he charged five magnums of champagne at $3,200 a pop. That case yet to be resolved. A month later, the husband of a Bangladeshi diplomat sued Scores for a $129,000 bill, saying the club got him drunk and then ran up his tab. after the suit was filed, his wife lost her job as a senior consular officer at the UN, and he was recalled to Bangladesh. That one is also unresolved. July 04, salesman James Webb filed suit that his signature was forged on a $22,800 American Express bill. Guess what club? Also at Scores.
Yep.
Look, if you want a lap dance, go to Hustler. I mean, what are you going to do? This is like, hey, it is ridiculous. First of all, Scores must be clocking some serious money.
Oh, Scores is doing very, very well.
This is stupid money.
The other thing, Riley, that, you know, like you said, is that, you know, these guys, they live in these insular worlds, these corporate titans, and some of them aren't even such big shots, such amazing big shots.
Yeah.
But in the world of the companies that they run, they're big shots.
They're movers. They're shakers. They're hard chargers.
Right. They go into the office and the secretaries kiss their butts and all the people underneath them kiss their butts and make them feel like they're the big tough guy, big man on campus.
Yeah.
And you know, over many years of being treated that way by the people around you, you end up taking those sort of airs out on the street with you. And you go out into the world and you expect everyone to treat you that way and everyone to kowtow to you and everyone to give you whatever you want. And they have this totally unfounded sense of entitlement, and they think they can just walk into a strip club and everything should be for free, or they can hand a guy a credit card and get whatever they want.
Well, this guy, McCormick, this doofus, makes $600,000 a year, so I guess he could probably afford to pay if he absolutely had to. And his officials of his company say that he actually did patronize Scores on the night in question. By the way, Savvis Communications is an ISP. It's an internet service provider. So if you ever see that pop up in one of those little advertisements, be sure to ignore it. Right now, this genius's stock is at 68 cents a share, folks.
Yeah, and if you have Savvis internet access and you start getting porn offers in your email from Scores, it might be that guy paying his debt off.
You're right. We've got more for you coming up shortly. We've got the dog of the week. We've got Tom DeLay. We've got historian William Lauren Katz. Stay with us. It's the home stretch of Air America Radio's Morning Sedition, 57 past the hour. Good morning. 6 minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is in California getting ready to do a gig tomorrow night at the Osher Marin County JCC in San Rafael. So if you're out there, check it out. Special good morning to all the immigrants, those new to our great country. Special good morning to those living paycheck to paycheck, people who walk to work. Good morning. And to people
who...
Morning
to you, too.
Hey, oh, you walk to work, man?
I live paycheck to paycheck.
Oh, you live paycheck to paycheck. Okay, well, that could be most of the guys in that room over there and most of the guys in this room, too.
That is correct.
Hey, and of course, we also want to say good morning to people who work the land. I'm talking about farmers. You know, we don't give a lot of farmers a great deal of respect. They've been up hours now, by the way. They're usually up about the same time we are. Good morning to the people who assemble iPods and to the people that assemble automobiles.
You mean Japanese people?
Well, whoever. And a special good morning.
Oh,
yeah, there you go.
But they're made in Japan, that's all.
Oh, no, not necessarily. They could be made of Japanese product, you know.
Taiwan.
Yeah, or right, Taiwan. Yeah.
Okay, that's probably true, yeah.
Japan, Korea, wherever. But I want to say a special good morning to people who really think they can change the world. And to home buyers and apartment seekers, and you know who you are, lots of luck this morning, okay?
You mean Jim Earle?
Well, whatever.
Who you can email at jearle@airamericaradio.com. If you have a two-bedroom apartment or one-bedroom.
I think
it was
a one-bedroom apartment for $1,600 or less.
Yeah, in Park Slope.
Yeah, right. He's got a prayer.
Yeah, good luck, Jim.
Yeah. Enjoy the closet, okay? Anyway, it is time now for a little thing we like to call the Dog of the Week. You know, Dan Pashman, there are few things more doggish than exploiting those less fortunate than yourself. That's why this week we found a dog that's not from Washington, but from the ATL, Atlanta, Georgia. There's an activist down there, an anti-immigration activist named D.A. King. This week he held a rally at the state capitol to make his point that people who are not citizens should not get taxpayer-funded benefits. He's an idiot, but to rally and demonstrate is his right. His wrong? He admits to hiring more than a dozen homeless people to carry signs at the rally. Like the biggest problem facing the homeless is immigration, legal or otherwise. Those homeless who rallied got paid all of $10 for their trouble. And D.A. King says he sees nothing wrong with pimping them out like this. The obvious question is, where is D.A. King's organization? Where are the citizens of Atlanta who agree with him and who would march and rally for nothing to back his cause? There's always a taint to those descendants of immigrants who work so hard to keep others out. So, D.A. King, shame on you for your utter failure to rally people for your cause, or to your cause, I should say, and for pimping the homeless below and beyond the call of duty. You are, in fact, the Morning Sedition Dog of the Week.
Yeah, that was a pretty amazing story, Riley.
Yeah, it was. And thank you for digging it up, man, because Dan Pashman was the one that turned me on to this particular story. Yeah. The guy is just, like, useless.
Paying homeless people to hold up signs in your rally.
Gee, you know, what's going to be next? What else are people going to be willing to underpay the homeless to do?
Right.
You know, because that's exactly what it turns out to be. Now, speaking of underpaid and probably undernominated, we're going to talk now about Harriet Myers.
Yeah.
Whose nomination may well be going down the tubes. But you know what? Before we talk about Harriet Myers, I want to talk about something that's a little uplifting this morning for people.
Yeah.
Because there is some good news on the breast cancer fighting front. It's being called the greatest breakthrough in breast cancer therapy in a decade. It's a drug that targets a particularly aggressive type of cancer that can cut the risk of relapse in half. This is according not to one, but to two new studies. For a specific type of breast cancer, which is triggered by an overactive gene called HER2, the drug Herceptin can significantly improve survival rates. This kind of cancer that this drug treats accounts for 15 to 25% of all breast cancers. So this drug could be used to help up to 50,000 patients and potentially save thousands of lives. Now, there are some risks involved in using this drug, including that of heart failure. And it's unclear whether that drug, whether the danger would grow if the drug was taken long term. But so many people, certainly in our listening audience and in our world, have been affected negatively by breast cancer. And I don't care how much you try and empathize. As a guy, I don't think we'll ever understand what it's like for a woman to go through that.
Okay? I think that's true, Mark. And it's one of those diseases, one of those illnesses that has probably touched pretty much every person, you know, in one way or another, a friend, a family member. I had a friend of mine who lost his mother to breast cancer around the age of 50. She was, and he's my age. He's 28. His mother has passed away because of breast cancer. And so, you know, it is good news. It's unfortunate that it's taken as long as it has, and so many people have died. But fortunately and hopefully we can save some lives in the future.
Yeah, two new studies, and hopefully that means that they will go forward from there and even get more drugs that will treat more types of breast cancer, so that more lives, in fact, can be saved.
Yes.
Now back to Harriet Myers.
Right.
I don't know if she, you know, we asked Michael Wolff last hour if Dick Cheney was going down. I got to tell you, it doesn't look like Harriet Myers' nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court is going anywhere. Not after Arlen Specter and Pat Leahy from Vermont, two members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, in a rare show of bipartisan action, asked her to come back with a completed questionnaire, right, because the one she submitted wasn't finished, wasn't completed, wasn't done right.
And not only not finished, but now we're hearing from Raw Story and from other places that there may have been some deceptions, some incomplete answers, and possibly some outright lies.
Well, wait a minute. The Bush administration likes to call those discrepancies. Discrepancies in the record.
Discrepancies between the truth and the Bush administration.
And the Bush administration. Yeah. Now, I don't know. This could have been an oversight. Apparently, she served on the board of directors of a real estate investment company that was later investigated, and I believe there was some sort of a civil trial involved.
Yeah.
They were exonerated. But for whatever reason, she didn't put this down when she was asked about you know, her past employment history. Now, given the fact that she's not a judge, she has no judicial prior history, you'd think she'd be really, really meticulous about her actual prior history, okay? Serving on the Dallas City Council, being being head of the Texas Bar Association, all these things that they were touting her so much for, you would have thought that she'd have dotted every I and crossed every T in terms of her resume, because so many people were saying she didn't really have one of any substance. But no, apparently she just turns around and gives up an incomplete questionnaire with some stuff that you could call borderline lies in them. I don't see how this stands.
You're right, Mark. And, you know, you talk about crossing the T's and dotting the I's, and I think that what we're really seeing here is the impact of what happens when the Bush administration does not have Karl Rove able to focus his full energy on orchestrating this kind of thing. Let's harken back to John Roberts.
Yeah.
His nomination of just a few months ago. And let's remember how perfectly packaged that was.
It was stage managed to the max.
He had his wife and kids ready for the photo op. They had their talking points ready. They had their talking heads ready to go out on all the cable news shows and talk this guy up. They had the editorials ready and the columnists ready to talk about what a great guy, what a perfect nomination it was. Everyone was in line. Everything was managed perfectly. It was rolled out like any marketing director's dream.
Yeah.
And now you look at contrast a couple months later after this leak thing has started to seep throughout the White House and has monopolized so much of Rove and Libby and Andrew Card and so many of the Bush's minions. So much of their time has been monopolized by this. And you see what happens when Bush does not have these guys to stage manage.
Well, yeah.
And to cross those T's and dot
those
I's.
Yeah, and Rove apparently, at least according to some published reports we've seen earlier this week, Rove is putting this all on Card, saying that it was Card's fault that the Harriet Myers rollout did not occur correctly, did not occur properly.
Right.
Now, the question I have is, if Karl Rove was working on this full-time, would he have not prevailed on her by now to withdraw her own name?
Well, I'm not so sure that she ever would have been nominated if Rove was calling the shots. But even if he had been, I'm sure that he would have found a much better way to package it. And I got to tell you, Riley, I'm so excited about this Karl Rove v. Andrew Card feud.
Oh, yeah.
It's so much fun because I just picture Bush in the corner with his legs folded up against his chest, rocking back and forth, saying, like, Mommy and Daddy aren't fighting. Mommy and Daddy aren't fighting. And you know that he is just up a creek without a paddle without these guys all on the same page.
Well, yeah, and they're not on the same page. The administration seems to be at war with itself. The Republican Party seems to be at war with itself to the point that the Republicans out in California deeply resented George W. Bush coming to their state for a fundraiser, for God's sake. Now, ordinarily, this would have created spasms of joy in the hearts of most Republicans in most states across the country. The problem here, Bush is coming out there to raise money for the Republican National Committee, and at the same time, California's Republicans are trying to raise money to keep the bodybuilder in the state house in Sacramento.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not working out for him. Apparently, he's short of his, much like the National Guard, short of his recruiting goals.
If ever there was a sign, Mark, of how far Bush's stock has fallen among his own party, it is this rejection that he received in California. For Schwarzenegger and for other Republican Party people in California to flat out be quoted in the press, not anonymous quotes, not background, quoted in the press as saying, we wish Bush hadn't come here,
yeah,
is really quite damning, because just a few months ago, those people were jumping over each other just to get in the photo behind Bush, wherever the hell he was.
Yeah, man, you could feel the love. I don't know exactly what's going on, but it does not bode well for the rest of the Bush administration,
yeah,
which, God, we're saddled with until 2008. Coming up, William Lauren Katz is going to tell us stuff. Now, you know, I thought I knew a little bit about history before I met William Lauren Katz.
Okay.
This is a guy who has chronicled the role of African Americans in an area that most people don't think African Americans even had any presence in, and that is the Old West. And we're here to talk about the re-release of his new book, Black West, a documentary and pictorial history of the African-American role in the westward expansion of the United States. That's going to be a lot of fun. Stay with us for that. We're also going to talk about the Republicans. You know, they haven't been totally paralyzed by the Bush thing. They managed to push something through that warmed the cockles of the National Rifle Association's hearts. We're going to get to that and much, much more next on Air America Radio. It's 17 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Now, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is in California. He'll be back on Monday. I'll be out on Monday. We'll be back together on Tuesday. The crew is coming in and out. It's like rush hour in here. It's amazing. We've got Brendan McDonald will be back from his honeymoon next week. Dan Pashman will be leaving, not for his honeymoon, also next week. So I don't know. I don't know when the whole crew is going to get back. But Dave Little Goliath is still here. Damn it.
He's not going anywhere.
No. Now, if you're just waking up, Hurricane Wilma is still a Category 4 storm. It has hit the Yucatan. It's just about made landfall. They're saying it may hit Florida by Sunday. And we've also got bad news. One of the defense lawyers in Saddam Hussein's trial, who was kidnapped yesterday, has been found dead.
Yeah.
And that is, obviously, when somebody dies like that, it is a true tragedy. Now, here in the United States, Congress has managed to do one thing that has warmed the cockles of the Bush administration's heart. In other words, everyone is not completely paralyzed by this scandal. Certainly not paralyzed enough not to throw a bone to the National Rifle Association. Now, I got to be honest with you. I hate guns, okay? I went to military school for 3 years. I learned how to shoot a gun. I was a marksman by the time I left there. But I still hate guns. I hate the idea of guns, first of all, being used to bring violence on people, but I don't even like guns to be used on animals. I mean, even animals that piss me off sometimes. I don't want to shoot them, okay? There ought to be a better way for people to spend their time than shooting a deer at 150 or 200 yards or blowing the head off a squirrel or some of that other stuff that people do. But now, Congress, in its finite wisdom, the House of Representatives voted 283 to 144 to send a bill to the president. And, of course, the Senate passed the same bill or a variation of it back in July. This would essentially protect the firearms industry from crime victim lawsuits brought by people who have had family or loved ones shot by guns. Not only that, it would dismiss all lawsuits that are currently pending in regard to crime victims who were trying to seek some redress from the gun industry, which, by the way, has been absolutely shameless in the way it sells guns. You know, one time, a couple of years ago, I ended up in Pennsylvania at a hotel, don't ask me how, where there was a gun show going on at the same time. And I don't like to generalize about people. I don't like to say, you know, I hate all hunters. That's not really the way I do things or the way I look at the world. But you see this stuff up close and personal, and you got to wonder, how, you know, because some of these guys really look like they had no interest in animals whatsoever. They were doomsday guys who were, you know, lining up a bunker down 50 feet under their house with cement and all the rest of this stuff and water supplies, and they were getting guns just in case anybody knocked at their door or something.
Yeah.
I just have a very, very serious problem with the unregulated gun industry and this bill, which the president has said he will sign, is going to go even one step further in deregulating the gun industry. They can show as many women as they want in bikinis with you know, sidearms and all the rest
Uzis.
Of that. Uzis, the whole nine yards. And by the way, I'm not making this up, folks. This is, in fact, how the gun industry markets to people.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, there's a few things that really upset me about this, Mark. You know, and make no mistake, this is a massive favor to the gun industry. They have wanted this for years. This protects them from lawsuits. And as many of you say, oh, those could be frivolous lawsuits. Well, no, a lot of these lawsuits contend and have very strong evidence to show that the gun industry has been careless and has flaunted many of the regulations that are supposed to keep the guns out of the hands of the wrong people. Now, the gun industry is circumventing those rules to get guns into the hands of the wrong people. Then they should be held responsible when those wrong people use those guns for wrongdoing. But I'm going to make a couple other quick points. First, This piece of legislation is great evidence of the fact that in spite of this leak investigation, in spite of Iraq, in spite of Harriet Myers and all the things that are going wrong for the GOP, they are still quietly but slowly and surely getting so much of their far right wing agenda slipped through under the radar. And this is yet another cog in the wheel. Second of all, the right wing says they're the party to fight the war on terror. Well, we know we found terror training manuals in Afghanistan in Osama bin Laden's hideouts that say, go to America, you can get guns there.
Yeah.
And the Republicans say they're the party to fight the war on terror, yet they are on the side of the NRA every time. All right, third of all, where are the Democrats? Okay, where are the Democrats?
I guess they're the 144 that voted against. But by the way, there are 200 and some odd in In the House. So a lot of Democrats voted for this piece of crap.
Right, but gun control is an issue that most Americans want to see restrictions on how people can have guns, and there is no Democratic leadership standing up for that. The majority is on our side, and we are not standing up for it.
Where are you, Democrats? Well, at any rate, we're going to take a quick break. And coming up next, historian William Lauren Katz will talk about a time when guns did rule. We're going to talk about Black West, a documentary and pictorial history of the African-American role in the westward expansion of the United States. Next on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is out on the West Coast. We've got a very special guest in studio. Coming up, we've got Cliff Notes, and we're going to talk a little bit about a controversy that's currently racking the National Basketball Association about what to wear. But first, it's not well known that African Americans played a large role in creating the Western frontier. Our next guest is the author of several award-winning books on African American history. A new edition of his book, The Black West, which documents the lives of African Americans out west in the 1800s, is in stores now. William Lauren Katz joins us in studio this morning. Welcome and good morning to you, Bill.
Great to be back with you, Mark.
Thank you so much. Now, this is a re-release of a book that, you know, and I have to say, and I said this earlier in the broadcast before you got here, I thought I knew something about history, okay, before we met the first time, which is some years ago.
Many years ago.
And, you know, I read this book and some of your other work. I said, wow, I don't know nothing. What, first of all, inspired you to dig this deep about this unknown part of Black history?
Well, I was a teacher back in the 1950s, and there was none of this in the school textbooks. And I happened to grow up in a home with my father had a great interest in Black history. So I had these books by Du Bois and others on the shelves. I began to dig in this, and the West began to fascinate me because we kids who grew up then all went to those movies, and
yeah.
We thought that was American history, though they were lily white,
mm-hmm.
until I began to dig into this.
Now, tell us a bit about the re-release of the book. Of course, I saw the original publication. What have you added in this new edition?
Well, I've added almost 100 new pictures, 12 new documents. I've fleshed out a lot of the fascinating people that I had in there with new information, come up with some new people like Bob Lemons, mm-hmm. who used to round up Mustangs, these wild horses out in Texas by acting like one of them, traveling with them, letting them smell them, eating with them,
what?
Traveling with them, and then leading them into a corral.
Really?
When the other people around the Mustangs were killing most of them in order to get these horses. So
wow.
I have a whole new group of people. I have some of the great old people like Stagecoach Mary,
yeah.
6 foot, 200 pounds of trouble, in her 70s, drove a stagecoach and delivered the U.S. mail in Cascade, Montana.
Wait a minute. Now, this is a Black woman who's 6 foot, 200 pounds, with a gun.
With two guns.
Right. And she, of course, stagecoach drivers at that time were charged with protecting whatever, not just the passengers, but whatever freight of anything of value that was on the stage. So she, I guess, did a pretty good job. Huh?
She not only did a good job, when she opened the laundry, a man came in one day, picked up his laundry, refused to pay, said, what can a woman do about that? Well, he found out. She trailed after him, tapped him on the shoulder. When he turned around, she laid him out with a right cross to the jaw, said, your bill's been paid in full, and went back.
Well, wow. Now, tell us where your history begins chronologically. Where was the first presence of Blacks in the West that you began to look at?
Okay, I began to pick it up in 1502 when Governor...
Wow, that's early.
That's very early, right. That's the point. Because that's the first mention where Governor Ovando of Hispaniola is complaining that his Africans, and this is the way he put it, fled among the Indians and never could be recaptured. And I believe those last four words tell us that really what's happening is the first rainbow coalition is forming out there beyond the European settlements. So I picked that up. And I, of course, have a lot on the relationship between African Americans and Native Americans which is very important because they become our first freedom fighters in the Americas. This is, you know, decades before the Declaration of Independence and those wonderful words. African Americans, Native Americans had maroon settlements. They were uniting. By the way, some of them were even ruled by black women.
Really? Now, I had heard about that in Brazil, I believe.
That's
or somewhere in South America. There was a woman who was, fearsome warrior, who they eventually had to make a deal with. But let me ask you something about the relationship between Native Americans and African Americans. Because we hear now that there were some Native American tribes that actually kept both African Americans and Native Americans as slaves. True?
That's true. But what we have to understand is that it didn't start that way. This was promulgated and promoted by the Europeans because they were trying to close down the leaks in their slave system. Uh-huh. The Africans were escaping to the Indians, and the Indians were taking them in because they had been enslaved first. They knew what it was. And by the way, they had been enslaved with Africans, so they were taking in many instances, their own brothers and sisters, mothers, fathers, sons, daughters, and so on.
Mm. Now, what was it that led, you say that the European slave trade more or less led to Indians beginning to traffic in it. Which were the tribes that were most heavily involved in slavery?
Well, they concentrated in the South because that's where most of the slaves were. So they gave gifts of African slaves to what they called the five civilized nations. They didn't call them that until they began to adopt some form of slavery. That made them civilized.
Oh, wow.
But the thing to understand is that the people of African descent who were enslaved by Native Americans enjoyed a level of camaraderie. We ate out of the same pot, is the way many of them put it.
So, in other words, it wasn't, it didn't have the brutality of the transatlantic slave.
No, it didn't have anything like that. They could marry, they could become free, and many of them became important members after the Civil War of the. And by the way, in the Seminole Nation, you had the greatest mixture of Africans and Native Americans, and they formed a united front to fight the U.S. Army, Navy, and Marines to a standstill for 42 years.
This was in Florida.
In Florida.
Incredible.
And they just went on and on like that.
Author and historian William Lauren Katz is our guest in studio. The name of his book, The Black West. Let's fast forward a little bit, Bill, and talk about how blacks participated in the westward expansion of the country, particularly after the Civil War.
Well, you had two major black migrations. I mean, you had a lot of black individuals going out alone. I'm thinking like Elvira Conley, a former slave, goes out to Kansas, opens a laundry, makes good friends with Buffalo Bill and Wild Bill Hickok. Good idea for a single woman in a shoot-em-up town. But a lot went out in the 1879, for example. A lot of former slaves just fed up with the Ku Klux Klan, fed up with the denial of freedom, walked up the Chisholm Trail, took boats if they could afford it up the Mississippi, and they went to Kansas, thousands of them.
Now, I got to ask you a question about that, because at the same time, there were large land grants being afforded people who wanted to settle these places, which at that time were territories. They were not yet states.
That's correct.
Were blacks able to take advantage of these kinds of land grants, or did racism prevent them from doing so?
No, actually, let me give you a clear example. Oklahoma. When 100,000 people lined up in 1889 to make a run for all that free land in Oklahoma, we now know there were about 10,000 black people puffing, running on bicycles, horses, carts, whatever, and they grabbed towns. And this is important. This is what I cover a whole chapter on. There were 32 all-black towns in Oklahoma.
What?
Between 1890 and 1910, self-governing towns. They got pictures of the town council of Boley, and let me add another thing to it. They were so intent on getting that part of the American dream that the literacy rate in some of these towns was at 95%, which was higher than the white towns.
Now, you mentioned Boley, Oklahoma. What are the names of some of the other towns?
Boley, Langston City, there are a whole slew of them.
Lasted a relatively brief period from 1892 to 1910.
Yeah, most of them went under. And by the way, in 1907, when Oklahoma came into the Union as a state, it became a Jim Crow discriminating state, lynchings, and black people were denied the right to vote. And, of course, they lost their economic power along with the political power because the railroads wouldn't stop at their towns. They went on to the white towns.
To the white towns. Incredible story. Now, when you look at some of the characters that were involved here, do you see any direct parallels in terms of people being settled in these areas, and some of these same, obviously the black towns are no longer there, but the families of people that settled back then, do some of them still live and still work the land in these part, in that part of the country?
And some of them they do. But there's a whole big battle for black farmers today to hold yes. on to what they have and out there, because I mean Oklahoma becomes another segregationist state. It's the first state to segregate telephone booths when it comes into the union. So they become part of this oppressive system.
Now, did blacks participate in the political system of Oklahoma prior to the advent of this racism, which came as Florida became a Oklahoma became a state?
Yeah, no, they. I have this wonderful picture of the town council of Boland. You can see the mayor there. You can see the sheriff. They ran their own businesses. They built churches. They built schools. They were part of political life. As a matter of fact, you had a man named Edwin P. McCabe who came out there, founded this Langston City, and his aim was to turn Oklahoma into a black state by getting black voting majorities in each congressional district.
Uh-oh.
Yeah,
yeah,
right.
They kind of squashed that.
They shot at him.
And, now, let me ask you something. Tell me a bit about a character that I found fascinating, because I read about him not just in your book, but in a book about capital punishment, a guy named Cherokee Bill.
Cherokee Bill was almost as bad as Billy the Kid, who, by the way, I have to tell our fellow New Yorkers, was a buck-tooth moronic mass murderer from New York City.
I heard he was from New York City.
He was from New York City, William Bonney. Well, Cherokee Bill was almost as bad, and he shot up Oklahoma, and he finally got captured, and he killed, by the way, I have to tell you, without regard to race, color, creed, or whether
he killed anybody.
Any people were armed or not. he was no more decent character than Billy the Kid. But the interesting story about him, they took him out to hang him, finally, and they put the rope around his neck, and they said to him, "Do you have any final words to say?" Tough to the end, he said, "No, I came here to die, not make a speech."
Oh, Lord. And then they pulled the trapdoor out of him, and Cherokee it. Bill was no more. Were there a number of black outlaws, Bill?
Yeah, there was the Rufus Buck Gang. I have a whole section on him that's new to the book this time. And they followed in the tradition of Cherokee Bill. They were very young guys. They look in their early teens. They're a mixture of Creek Indians and African Americans. And they shot up Oklahoma and killed more people than the Star Gang and the other gangs combined until they were apprehended and put away.
And put away. Now, did they also attack people without regard to race? I assume even black outlaws might have hesitated at the time at attacking white folks.
No. It's interesting. There were some gangs out there, some of these outlaw gangs that were black outlaw gangs that actually tried to do good things for the black community, but others were just in that Billy the Kid tradition, shoot up the place, grab what you can.
Mm-hmm. Finally, Bill, you've been doing this for a long, long time, and obviously your work has done a lot to disseminate this information. Is it out there more now than it has been in the past?
Yeah, it's getting out there, and Hollywood has taken notice, you know, and certain movies and like Posse and so on,
yeah.
Which you and I think saw together one time.
Yeah, I think we did.
Right, and you know, it's getting out there, and I'm actually talking with somebody about doing a documentary based on this new edition of The Black West, which I hope will move forward.
All right. The name of the book, The Black West, a documentary and pictorial history of the African-American role in the westward expansion of the United States. Professor William Lauren Katz, thank you so much for being with
Great
us.
Great for having me on, Mark.
Hey, have you back again soon.
Great.
It's 47 minutes past the hour. We're going to come back with some closing thoughts and the Cliff Notes here on Morning Sedition Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
Bill, 51 minutes past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name's Mark Reilly. Mark Maron is out in San Francisco, California. He'll be at the Osher or Osher? Let me make sure I don't mispronounce it. Osher, Marin County JCC in San Rafael, California, tomorrow night at 8 p.m. For tickets, go to marinjcc.org. You know, one of the things that we haven't had a chance to talk a great deal about during the course of this week is a controversy that is roiling the world of sports. We're talking specifically the National Basketball Association, where Commissioner David Stern has outlawed bling. Ladies and gentlemen, David Stern has said, no more bling in the NBA. That's right. I mean, he is outlawed, among other things, he's outlawed caps, he's outlawed bandanas, he's outlawed what are euphemistically called in the community, do-rags. He has also outlawed jerseys. So, in other words, players can't walk into the arena with jerseys on if they're doing any kind of team business. And they've also outlawed the many of the chains that a lot of ball players wear, and some of them look like Mr. T, for Christ's sake. I mean, they got them all over themselves. What's interesting about this is, A, the reaction of the players. A lot of players are very, very upset about this. Marcus Camby, who plays for the Denver Nuggets, used to play here in New York, said that the NBA, if they're going to dictate how the athletes should dress, then they should pay for the outfits that they dress in. Now, mind you, the average NBA ball player makes ka-ching, $4 million a year.
Hello.
Which is enough, I assume, to buy pretty much any kind of wardrobe you might want.
And now they got to dress for, like, Catholic school.
Yeah, for, like, Catholic. Exactly. And I got to tell you, many, many years ago, I used to cover the Knicks at the Garden when I first started working in radio. Ooh. And I'll never forget getting ready to leave the Garden one time. Actually, I was going down into the locker room. I was coming back for the locker room.
Actually, you were hanging around the
hanging
locker
around
room.
Hanging around the locker room. No.
Which is why you're not covering them anymore. It's, right. It's an ugly story.
It was actually a hamper full of underwear.
The women's locker room, and it's a bad story.
No, it was a WNBA story. No, it's not. No, but the elevator door opened, and before me were the Boston Celtics. All of them. I think it was like about six of them. They were all dressed up in these pea green jackets, identical shirts, and identical ties. JoJo White, Dave Cowens, all of these guys, John Havlicek was still playing in. And I looked at these guys and said, whoa, because they were all dressed exactly the same way. Now, mind you, as the NBA comes up with this particular dress code, they may have forgotten that back in the day, back in that same generation, you had Bill Walton, who wore a bandana everywhere because his hair was down to his down below his neck.
Well, at this point, you know, the NBA is just they're looking out for gang colors. That's, you know,
yeah, I mean, aren't there certain allegations, Riley, that race has been a factor in this decision?
Well, they say race has been a factor in this decision because most of the ball players are black, and the perception is that NBA audiences don't want to see players dressed like that, dressed like hoodlums, dressed like thugs, dressed like hip-hop kids. Now, mind you, these players are not hoodlums or thugs or hip-hop kids. Maybe, you know, Ron Artest may have wanted to make a
record. I got two words for this discussion. Dennis Rodman. Thank you. I'm done.
Well, see, Dennis Rodman may have led to part of the backlash here. Yeah. The problem that they have is that David Stern has spent the previous 5 or 6 years marketing the NBA to fans around the world as this hip-hop, you know, influenced league. If you listen to the music that they use in the background for NBA commercials, you find that it is, in fact, hip-hop. So what are they saying? Are these mixed messages they got going on there?
Well, you know, maybe if just everybody wore the same bling, that could be the uniform.
Identical. Yeah, I'd like to be the jeweler.
Identical bling. That would actually be kind of impressive.
Well, before we get out of here, it is time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes, and here to read them is the legendary
Barry Lane. The legend. For those who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about in this program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. A congressional investigation reveals that Army National Guard units in the U.S. are short of vital equipment like Humvees because they had to leave it in Iraq for replacement troops. The Pennsylvania Guard had to leave behind so much equipment that the state had to borrow supplies from the Amish Guardsmen, including several hundred non-machine guns. The good news is that Iraq is perfectly prepared for a hurricane in Florida. A Walmart heiress has lost her USC diploma. It's the University of Southern California, one of my father's alma maters, in fact. After her college roommate revealed the heiress paid her to do her papers and assignments, Paige Laurie recently gave her diploma back to the university
Okay, she paid someone else to give it back, but that still counts. The heiress paid her roommate $20,000 to do her homework until she found several Chinese students who would do it for a quarter of the price. The Chinese police are investigating reports of attempts to sell baby on eBay's Chinese websites. Already, the government has filed a complaint with China for selling cheap knockoffs of expensive American babies. Phrase of the day. Just drop it into conversation. Hurricane Wilma is still strong after being the most powerful storm ever recorded. Still don't think global warming is real. Wake up, sheeple. You don't need a weatherman to know which way the trailer park blows.
Oh. That's us, folks. Thank you, Barry Lake. Thank you all in the booth. Hey, man, none of you guys told me my fly was open all morning. What's up? You're supposed to be my friends.
Sorry.
Sucker.
We love
Mary's
it.
Back Monday. Air
we
liked
watching
Radio.
It.